Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. As always, I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Wait, let me check that. Yep, I'm still Matt Salmon. And as always, I thank you for listening. And I don't have to check with this. I'm pretty confident. I am very thankful that you listen to this podcast. And also thankful that you're helping decide the future direction of the podcast as we are getting close to the end of the big old monster box of baseball cards. Just two more sets to look at. We'll take a look at 93 Tops in our next podcast. That'll be coming your way on Tuesday via Audio Boom and iTunes. As for this podcast, we look at an incredible set, the 1993 Upper Deck set, which not only answered the questions and critics about could Upper Deck keep up with the competition, which was very rapidly closing in on Upper Deck, especially in 1992, but it not only answered the questions then, but it still is a pretty popular set now, especially because of a lot of the insert cards that were featured mostly in Series 2 of the set, but throughout the set, a lot of great cards, a great design, and very, very popular to this day. And when you're talking about a tremendous set, you might as well talk about a tremendous player, and none more tremendous from this era of baseball than Cal Ripken Jr. Card number 585 are a random pull, and again, just a reminder, the cards that I have from these particular sets, because I got rid of a lot of them in my great card purge of several years ago, a lot of the cards that I kept are superstar cards or semi-star cards or big rookie cards. So you're going to have some very popular players in the tail end of the Wax Ecstatic podcast first run, if you will. So you don't get the common players, you don't get the more obscure players most of the time, but you get some pretty darn good players. And again, Cal Ripken Jr., everyone knows about his career, of course, surpassing Lou Gehrig for consecutive games played back in 1995, and he would extend that record by over 500 games. But a couple of interesting tidbits about his career we'll get to a little later on after we talk about the 93 Upper Deck set. And after we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, and a lot of the times the conversation at Wax and Gum Stains is talking about the most recent podcast we've talked about or the most recent player that we featured in a random pull. I do know, like, our friend WaxPack916 went out and bought some 92 Fleer Ultra based on our podcast, and it is a great set. I hope you pulled some really nice cards out of that box recently. But a lot of the talk in the last few days has been about our Wax Ecstatic survey, and it's because I want you to give me a little feedback on what you like, what you don't like about the show, but also where does it go from here? And that was the big question, because we have several options out there. I could go any direction with it. And I appreciate your feedback. I appreciate everybody who did participate in the survey. Most of the survey publicity came out through Twitter. That's where we had the direct link to it. So based on the number of Twitter followers we have, we actually had a pretty good amount of people, pretty good percentage that took the survey. So I really appreciate that, because sometimes you put a survey out there and four people answer, and that doesn't really give you a good sample size. We had a pretty decent sample size for this. So again, thank you to those who took the time to answer the questions. Now, I want to save plenty of time to talk about the 93 Upper Deck set and Cal Ripken Jr., so let's get right to the results. And when you're talking about a survey, there's no better way to present the survey results than, well, sharing what the survey says. This may be one of my favorite TV game show themes of all time. You know, being a kid from the 80s, you know, Family Feud was already a juggernaut, and of course Richard Dawson jamming his tongue down every woman's throat was one of the highlights of this really goofy, inebriated host show. I think the show's gotten a little raunchy now. You know, that's just my own opinion. You know, hey, maybe 40 years ago it was considered raunchy, but you know, the Richard Dawson version is my favorite. The theme song is my favorite, or one of my favorites. I actually like Joker's Wild and Tic-Tac-Doe a little better. I was always a fan of the Jack Barry, Dan Enright shows, but anyways, we'll give it to you Family Feud style here, with Richard Dawson calling the shots as we go quickly through the questions here. The first question was just a very simple, pretty much a yes or no question here. In general, how much do you enjoy listening to Wax Ecstatic? And our options were, I absolutely love it, it's pretty good, and it's okay.
Survey said.
Well over 90% of our respondents say, I absolutely love it. The others say it's pretty good. Nobody just goes, eh, it's okay. So that really makes me happy. When we started doing this, you know, we basically structured it around the general idea of what we thought would make a good show. And just based on that answer alone, I know we're hitting the nail on the head for the most part. So that is good to know. All right, question number two. How did you find out about Wax Ecstatic? The options were, I found it while searching Audio Boom. I was referred to it by a friend. I found it when I discovered Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. I heard about it from Beckett Radio. I saw it while searching iTunes.
Survey said.
About 57% of the respondents say, I found it when I discovered Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. So, I always say, let a friend know, somebody who collected in the past or who still collects now, let them know about Wax and Gum Stains, and they can be part of the show too. So for those of you who have spread the word about Wax Ecstatic on Twitter through Wax and Gum Stains, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, next question. What is your favorite part of the content of the show? And our options were, I love talking baseball cards in general. I love looking back at the old card sets. I love looking back at the old players. I love the listener interaction with the host. And I'm not a huge baseball card collector. I just find the show entertaining.
Survey said.
45% of the respondents, I love looking back at the old card sets. And a close second with 35% of the response, I love talking baseball cards in general. So we're going to keep on doing that. We'll look back at the older cards and just talking about cards in general, as that pleases most of the people who took our survey. All right, next question. Oh, this is a tough one. About the host, what is your favorite part of what he does? The options are, he really knows about baseball cards and the sport of baseball. He's really funny. He seems personable, like I've known him for years. Nothing in particular. He's just a good host for the show.
Survey said.
55% of the respondents say he seems personable, like I've known him for years. Ah, oh, you love me. You really love me. Are my Harry Carey impressions, but definitely one of the two. Well, I thank you for that. Not that we were in the market for a new host, but at least I know that I'm doing a good enough job to entertain you for each and every episode, so I appreciate your commentary there. And one of the toughest things to do in broadcasting is to sound conversational, to make that connection with each and every listener. So to see that that was the leading response makes me feel good, makes me feel like I'm doing the right thing to entertain you with every episode. All right, now we get into the nuts and bolts of the show here. Next question. What would you like more of in the show? Our options were more listener interaction, more talk about the older card sets, more talk about the older players, more talk about newer cards and players, and more talk in general. The show is too short, which I would find hard to believe. But anyways,
survey said
52% of the respondents say more talk about the older card sets. And interestingly, nobody selecting more talk about newer cards and players, which leads nicely into our next question, which was, what would you like less of in the show? And basically, we just took the same question and said less, you know, instead of more. So less listener interaction, less talk about old cards, et cetera, et cetera.
Survey said.
And based on the previous question, I think you have an idea of what the leading answer was. Yes, a pretty dominant 64% saying no talk about newer cards or players. This is a junk wax show. So even though we may be leaving the junk wax era for some older cards, I get the message loud and clear. There's plenty of content out there talking about new releases. You want to talk about the old stuff, and I am totally fine with that. Now, with that said, every now and then, if there's news about a new product that comes out that I feel like sharing with you, I may do that, but I know where the focus of the show is. I've already shared my thoughts about the 2017 Topps set. You know I'm going to be pretty excited about the Topps Archive set coming out March 1st. But other than that, we'll leave pretty much everything else to the older shows. How much is this band getting paid to play the song? What are we on, like the fourth time they've played it? Fifth time? Okay, let's get back to the focus here. Next question, the big one. Where would you like the show to go from here? Pretty interesting array of answers. So let's give you the ones that we offered up. Go back to the 1981 baseball cards and work your way through 1993 again. Go back to your older baseball cards, 1954 to 80, and do the same thing. Move on to other older sports cards. And an option that was actually presented to us by a listener, do a quote-unquote pay-for-play pack or box break. Listeners pay to have packs opened and cards are shipped to them. And then we have the rather ubiquitous other box.
Survey said
40% of the vote says go back to your older baseball cards, 1954 through 80, and do the same thing. And I can also tell you, based on some of the comment boxes that were filled in, there's an overwhelming support for doing that. So we'll definitely do that. So moving forward, we're going to do some of the older baseball cards. After we get through the minor league cards and the team sets and non-logo cards, we will start with the lone 1954 Topps card I have. We'll have to skip over 55 and 56 because as of this moment, I don't have any of those. But then we'll proceed from 1957 through 1980. And we'll have a lot of fun with that. Now, I can also say that 30% of the respondents selected other in this question. And like I said, a few of them were talking about basically just saying do the older cards again. But there were some interesting comments that came along, some interesting suggestions such as a Where Are They Now type show, also, you know, having guests on the show. We actually did that back with episode 30, which you can look back at in our archive, talking about the author who found all of the players that were in a pack of 86 Tops, or at least the living players. There were a couple that had passed on. So we may do something like that, I think, to be honest with you. When hockey season is done and I've got a little more free time, I could start rounding up some guests and maybe have them on as a guest to the program. And simply because not only will I have more time, theoretically speaking, but also some of the older baseball card sets, some of the players I have are very common players, so there's not a whole lot of backstory to the random poll. I would imagine. So we may bring in somebody to help assist us with a show or two down the line there. All right, let's move on to the next question. Just a few more here. Should we eventually introduce a video component? Now, I ask this because, you know, on the broadcasting side, everybody says, you know, you've got to have mobile video, on-demand video, video. And okay, I'm all right with that, but I'm kind of a radio guy at heart. I see the potential and the benefits of audio only content as entertainment. But hey, what do I know? I wanted to ask you. You are the loyal fan of this podcast, so tell me more. So our options were no, the audio podcast is just fine as it is. Yes, looking at the cards while you're talking about them would be cool. And then yes, you should do a pack or box break with video.
Survey said
a pretty overwhelming response here. 71% say no, the audio podcast is just fine as it is. So we're going to keep doing the audio podcast. Now, with that said, because we did have about 28-29% of our respondents say that some kind of video would be cool to have, I can't totally turn a blind eye to, you know, almost a third of the respondents. So perhaps down the line, we introduce the occasional video here and there. But we'll definitely, as our core piece of content, stick with the audio podcast. Next question, if the podcast eventually moved to one day a week, would you be upset? Our options, yes, I need my Wax Ecstatic fix twice a week. No, one podcast a week is fine with me. And it doesn't really matter to me, just keep the shows coming.
Survey said!
Believe it or not, option number three. It doesn't matter, just keep them coming. And that's the on-demand world we live in. For some people, you get excited about 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Tuesday and Friday, because you know that's when the show gets posted. For others, it doesn't matter. You'll listen to it when you damn well please, and that's fine. The second place option, by the way, was number two. One podcast a week is fine with me. And I asked that question because, again, it's a labor of love to do these shows twice a week. But there may come a time where it's just a little too much, and I may scale it back just a little bit, but that is yet to be determined. Finally, question number 10 was a short answer portion of the quiz. What additional comments and suggestions do you have for the show? We've got some very interesting ones here. I'm not going to go through all of them because they're all over the map, but in a good way. And for those of you who presented those to me, I will take them to heart. I will definitely look over them, consider how we can, maybe not every show, but a little more often, work in some of the suggestions that you make. I do value your feedback, so we can, you know, definitely do that on a little more of a regular basis. And I also know a lot of the people who filled in this box basically just said, we enjoy listening to the show. Thank you very much. Somebody even said it's the best baseball card podcast out there, which is extremely humbling and flattering to me because, again, this idea was just that. It was an idea. About 6 months ago, we started doing it, and it has taken off like I never would have expected it to. So I owe that to you, the listeners, for not only buying into it and enjoying what we do, but also sharing the word about the podcast, about Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, and just really helping us grow the show organically. I've been very fortunate to where we've had some help along the way. You know, getting clearance on iTunes was a big thing. My appearance on the Beckett Radio podcast really helped spread the word. But a lot of the growth has come from you just sharing it with friends. So I can't thank you enough. And again, thanks to all who did take part in the survey. Again, your comments, your suggestions, your opinions are valued, and they will all be taken into consideration. And, you know, some of the changes or some of the suggestions that you made may not become blatantly obvious changes to the show, but there will be a few tweaks here and there based on some of the feedback. So don't think that I'm ignoring anything that you said. I'm certainly going to take the time to try to figure out how to factor in some of these things that you brought up. All right, as we wrap up the survey, just a reminder, Wax Ecstatic comes your way, at least for the meantime, twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays. 10 a.m. Eastern Time is when we post the show on Audio Boom, and we share it on Twitter, and you can also catch it on iTunes. And don't forget, you can listen to our archive at any time at audioboom.com. Just type in Wax Ecstatic in the search window, and you'll see all of our shows pop up there. All right, let's move on to the card that we're talking about today. That, of course, would be 93 Upper Deck, and it is a great set. And as I discussed in especially the 91 and 92 sets, there was a little bit of foreshadowing that Upper Deck, which totally turned the industry on its ear in 1989 and really set the bar high. And it was a bar that a lot of the other card companies didn't match, you know, at the very least, match until 1992. Upper Deck was by far the top card, the best quality, had the best inserts, the best, you know, counterfeit measures. You know, it just had everything to it. You had to pay a little more for it, but if you wanted a higher quality card and higher quality inserts, then Upper Deck was the way to go. And until Top Stadium Club put together the outstanding premier set in 1991, and then most everybody else fell in line by 1992, Upper Deck ruled the roost for the first definitely 3 years that it was in operation. But as I mentioned in the 92 Upper Deck podcast, where Frank Thomas was our random pull, the 92 set was a nice set. It was a good set. It was a popular set, but you started seeing not just Top Stadium Club, but also Fleer Ultra, you saw the Leaf Studio set, you saw Bowman, you know, all these other sets were starting to do better things than Upper Deck did. So Upper Deck was still up there, but they suddenly had a lot of competition on their heels in 1992. And as we've seen with some of the other sets from 1993, it would continue. And they had to make a better product. And in 1993, Upper Deck definitely did that. They released what was then the largest set in their history. It was 840 cards, done in just two series, 420 cards of each. A very popular design, which we'll get into. But again, especially the inserts. You had a lot of special inserts that dominated Series 2 of the set. So boxes of Series 2 are a little harder to come by, or a little more expensive, I should say, than Series 1. But you did have a couple of interesting sets that were inserted in here, including a fifth anniversary set, which I find interesting because the big craze around the new Topps series is the Rediscover Topps, where they put in old Topps cards and stamp it. By the way, I pulled an 86 Topps Don Robinson card with the red foil on it, so I'll try to make a quick $10 off of what is otherwise a 2-cent card. But, Topps is making a big deal of it. It's not the first time Topps has inserted old cards, but Upper Deck did that. A 15-card set, a slightly different design. They had a black border. But you had basically reprints of their older cards, like the 89 Ken Griffey Jr., a couple other notable names. I think Nolan Ryan, the one where he was pitching in the tuxedo. You had Chipper Jones, Frank Thomas, Roberto Alomar. So you had a lot of the big stars who had notable rookie cards in previous sets. Those were randomly inserted into Series 2 hobby packs. Now, you also had the usual home run heroes type cards, but then you had the Reggie Jackson clutch performers. And of course, Reggie Jackson did the inserts back in 1990. Well, there is a jumbo version of his hero card. So again, Reggie Jackson lending his name and likeness to Upper Deck. So that's a neat collectible. But there was also a special insert called Reggie Jackson's Clutch Performers. So again, Series 2. You can find those in hobby and retail packs. So basically, Reggie Jackson went out and chose his top 20 players at the time. And, there's really no surprises here. It's Ken Griffey Jr. and, Kirby Puckett and Frank Thomas and Will Clark and Jose Canseco. So, no surprises there. But again, another limited edition insert card that went in. You had a hologram set called Then and Now. It was reflections of, how the players had changed. So, of course, you had some players who had been around for a long time, such as Tony Gwynn, Ricky Henderson, Cal Ripken Jr., Nolan Ryan, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that series was split over the two series, but some of the much bigger names would be found in the second series, and that includes Reggie Jackson, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays. So that was, again, another added incentive to spending a little money on the second series as opposed to the first series. And then one of my favorite series of subsets, and this is because I've always admired this guy's work, Walter Yost. Now, that name may not ring a bell, probably because it's not spelled the way it sounds. I-O-O-S-S, longtime photographer with Sports Illustrated, along with several other publications. There was a 27 card, because there was a header card, but a 27 card collection called the Walter Yost Collection, and it featured some of his best photos, featuring some of the best players in the game. So, again, pretty much an all-star collection of cards here, candid pictures that were used, and this one was actually featured in the Series 1 jumbo pack. So this was the extra bait to keep buying Series 1, even though Series 2 was far more loaded with the inserts and more interesting cards. Also, Upper Deck, as they had done for previous years, did a Hall of Fame hero set. This time it was the Willie Mays collection, which was featured in Series 1. Not as heralded as some of the others, not because Willie Mays is not a heralded player, but he did not sign any of the cards. So in previous sets where you had Reggie Jackson signing cards and Ted Williams signing cards, Willie Mays did not autograph the cards. So while they are very unique insert cards, it was not something that hobbyists were tripping over one another because there wasn't that added incentive of trying to find an autograph parallel. Now, as for the set and the design, it's very popular. Let's take a look at our random poll again. Card number 585, Cal Ripken Jr. A great action shot of Ripken rounding third and heading for home, although it looks like he's stumbling drunk over the bag. So it's not exactly the best shot, but it's pretty good and very clear, great clarity good color, a very interesting action shot here. And Upper Deck in 93 especially had a really good mix of action shots and pose shots, but they also mixed in a lot of candid shots. And I remember one card in particular was the Mike Perez card. I remember pulling this from a pack once and doing not a double take, but I think a triple take. And basically what they did was Mike Perez was a pitcher for the Cardinals, and they got a picture of him in spring training. And I think the Cardinals were still in St. Pete at that time. So here's a picture of Mike Perez, and he's standing by a chain link fence, and he's holding a card, and he's got a marker in his hand, and it's like he's going to autograph the card. Well, if you look carefully, the card he is autographing is the card that he's pictured on. So it's one of those weird mirror images. Actually, it's like if you ever take a video camera and put it, up against a mirror and look in the viewfinder, you kind of get this, looking glass effect here. And that's exactly what they did there. But the Perez card is the best example, I think, of some of the unique candid cards that they had. Some really unique shots as well on the back of the card. One really funny card is Dennis Cook, who is a pitcher for the Indians. And he's holding a bat up high and actually looks kind of like Chief Wahoo. But also, I recall Mark McGwire's card from that year. The back of his card had a picture of him holding a camera, like taking a picture with a professional camera lens. So it's kind of, hey, here's a picture of a guy taking a picture. So, some really unique shots that were used here, and it certainly shook up what was starting to become a little bit of a rather ordinary feature to the Upper Deck set. Now, the Upper Deck set in 93 still had borders, although the white borders were getting a little slimmer. So it's a thin white border around the outside. Up top, you had Upper Deck, but that was always put in the background of the shot. So a great example is this Cal Ripken Jr. Picture where he's rounding third and his body is in the foreground while Upper Deck kind of floats in the background. Now, that would make for some very interesting photos. For example, this Cal Ripken card, because of where his head is in this shot, the letter D is not visible. So it looks like it says Upper Eck. And if Dennis Eckersley was pitching, that would be rather appropriate, but I can't really see him in the picture here. In fact, just kind of looking at the background, if that isn't the old Anaheim Stadium for the Angels, that may actually be a picture from the 1992 All-Star Game. That looks like Jack Murphy Stadium, but I'm merely just guessing here. I'm actually going to suggest it's probably Anaheim Stadium based on the picture on the back. And we'll get to that in a moment. But rounding out the front of the card, you had an autograph style font of the player's name, a gold color, which made it hard to read sometimes, but for the most part, you could see it. That was over a gradiated orangish bar, and then beneath that, you had a green bar with the player's team and position underneath it. Now, you flip the card over. You have nearly two-thirds of the card is dedicated to an action photo, and sometimes, like I said, the McGwire shot was a posed photo. So about two-thirds of the card is dedicated to the photo, and that's great. And here's Ripken basically calling off a teammate, going to catch a pop-up, it looks like here. And that looks like Anaheim Stadium because they had, this is back when the Rams played there and the stadium was enclosed, and you always had, a few thousand empty orangish red seats in the lower level of the outfield. And there's a whole wave of empty seats behind Ripken in this shot, along with the blurry racist Chief Wahoo. So you've got a whole lot going on in this picture, but a very clear picture, like I said, to the front of the card, a very similar clarity on the back of the card. Card number in the upper left-hand corner, the player name again presented at the base of the picture. It looks an awful lot like 93 score because you have his name and the position in this little strip underneath the card. Then you have the recent major league performance. As I've said before, I was never a big fan of just showing the recent major league performance, but that's something Upper Deck did for many years, and it worked with this design because they were able to devote so much of the back of the card to a picture. And then at the bottom, you have a litany of logos. You have the Upper Deck logo, MLB, MLBPA, and also the hologram logo. Now, an interesting thing about the hologram logo in 1993, Upper Deck decided to randomly produce some gold hologram factory sets, but there was no way of telling if you had a regular hologram or a gold hologram. So randomly inserted into cases were these gold hologram sets. So another unique factor of the 93 Upper Deck set with the difference in holograms. And hopefully they don't peel as much as some of the earlier editions, although again, we're now on 24 years and you know, time takes its toll on those little slivers of foil that were put there with good intentions to stop counterfeiting, but have actually kind of marred the value of cards because they have slowly started peeling off all these years later. So 93 Upper Deck, a great set. As I mentioned, more of the valued insert cards are in Series 2. So if you're going shopping for boxes, you can still get them at a pretty good price, but quick scan of what's out there right now. Series 2 is going to cost you a lot more than Series 1. I've seen Series 1 boxes for anywhere from $15 to $25. Series 2 anywhere from $35 to $45. So pretty much twice what you'd spend on a Series 1 box there. So if you're looking to compile the entire 93 Upper Deck set, just the base cards, never mind the inserts, you know, the entire 840 card set, it's going to cost you a little bit to try to make up the second series just because of all those inserts. They actually bump up the value of some of the wax packs that you can still find on the market these days. All right, our random pull is card number 585, Cal Ripken Jr., also known as Calvin Edwin Ripken Jr., of course, coming from the famous Ripken family. His father, Cal Sr., briefly a manager with the Baltimore Orioles, longtime player, coach, you name it, mentor in the game of baseball, and of course, Cal's brother, Billy. A utility infielder, played with Cal for several years in Baltimore, had the rather infamous 89 Fleer card, and is now a commentator on the MLB Network. Now, again, there's only so much you can say about Cal Ripken Jr., much like a lot of the other stars featured in some of our more recent podcasts. But let me just run down the career superlatives. Career batting average of .276, but more impressively, 431 home runs. Shortstops are not known for their power, but he was a power-hitting shortstop, without a doubt. 3,184 hits. Of course, the major league record, 2,632 consecutive games played. That is 502 more than Lou Gehrig, the longtime record holder. You know, Gehrig held that record for, 56 years? And Ripken rather infamously moving past Gehrig in one of the most watched baseball games in history back in 1995. He was finally able to move past Gehrig and kept that streak going up until one day late in the 1998 season. He just said that he was going to decide when he was going to break the streak. And, you know, he was dealing with some nagging injuries. There was some concern as the Orioles were starting to head downhill in 98-99 that, you know, the franchise may want to start showcasing new players in the infield positions and Ripken would get benched. And it had to be really tough for, I believe Buck Showalter was the manager of the Orioles then. It had to be really tough for managers around this time. You know, if Cal Ripken was not going to be a regular contributor, if his game starts slipping a little bit, and it really didn't. The funny thing is, in 1990, he batted .340. So maybe he lost a step, but not a whole lot. But it had to be tough for managers because you didn't want to be the guy that decided that Cal Ripken Jr. should sit down for a game. So Ripken decided to do it himself, September 20th, 1998, regular season game against the Yankees in Baltimore, and he decides that he's going to take a seat. So Ryan Miner, who is a rookie third baseman, thinks he's getting punked. You know, he's in the lineup. Okay, you're going to be replacing Ripken. So he didn't really take it all that seriously. And then all of a sudden, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. People caught on, like, you know, Ripken wasn't taking batting practice and, you know, he wasn't doing his usual game time routine. And just like that, without any fanfare or announcement, the streak was over. Now, how did the streak begin? It all started back in 1982. That's when the streak began. May 30th, 1982 was the last game that Ripken missed. It was the second game of a doubleheader. And then from then on out, he would appear in every single Baltimore Orioles game from the end of May 1982 through the end of September of 1998. Now, his career began as a second-round draft pick of the Orioles in 1978. He decided to go the pro route as opposed to college with a very interesting way of thinking about it. He thought that he was good enough to play professional ball, but if it didn't work out, then he could always just go back to college and earn a degree, as opposed to the other way, going to college, getting that degree while spending 4 years working your way to the majors. So while most players would take the latter approach, Ripken took the former approach, and it certainly worked out well for him. And of course, with his dad being involved in the Orioles organization, Cal was surrounded by some of the best players. I mean, think of some of the great players that were playing for the Orioles in the early to mid-70s. Even though the Orioles' glory days were starting to fade, you know, the Orioles were still, you know, American League champions in 71, world champions in 70, American League champions in 69. So Cal Ripken was just born and raised on some incredible players, picked up a lot of tips on how to play the game from Doug DeCinces, of course, a former third baseman. And that's where Ripken started as he was making his way up through high school and eventually into the pros. He was an infielder. But interestingly, he also in high school pitched. And there was some thought when he was being scouted by major league teams that Cal Ripken Jr. would be a pitcher in the major leagues as opposed to an infielder. And that's something that the Orioles liked. This was a guy who could go either way on the field. So they drafted him in the second round. Now, contrary to a popular story, Ripken was not drafted with a pick that was forfeited by the Boston Red Sox. Back in the early days of free agency, the owners tried to clutch and grab onto their former stranglehold of the reserve clause by having what was called a reentry draft, where a bunch of teams could basically bid for the rights to negotiate with a player. It's a very complicated system. The reentry draft only lasted a few years, but the reentry draft basically to try to keep some control over player movement. Free agents would have to go through this process, which pretty much narrowed down teams that could talk to them and kept the market down just a little bit. Well, the Red Sox were able to, through the reentry draft, pick up Dick Drago from the Orioles, and the Red Sox would surrender a draft pick for signing Drago away from the Orioles. Now, despite popular belief, that pick that the Red Sox forfeited for the right to sign Dick Drago, that was not the draft pick that was used to select Cal Ripken Jr. In fact, a catcher named Cecil Whitehead was used with the pick, and that pick from Boston came two picks after Cal Ripken Jr. was selected. But still, a second-round pick in 1978, and he starts making his way through the Orioles' minor league system. And like I said, there was some thought that maybe he could be a pitcher, but they decided to keep him in the infield with the general notion that if he wasn't good as an infielder, then they can put him on the mound and start working on his pitching game, because it is easier to take a position player, make him a pitcher, as opposed to taking a pitcher and making him a position player. And there's plenty of stories about that, not just Cal Ripken Jr., who stayed in the infield, but Edwin Jackson used to be an outfielder, was converted to a pitcher. Dave Steeb, one of my favorite players, he was an outfielder. And according to a lot of scouting reports, he wasn't a very good one. But he was sometimes, when he went to school at Southern Illinois, he was sometimes called upon to be an emergency pitcher. And he actually dominated from the mound. He wasn't a very good outfielder, but it was his pitching prowess that got the Blue Jays to draft him in 78. And even though Steve would start his minor league journey in the outfield, they quickly moved him back to the pitcher's mound, and you saw he had a very successful career there. So, there are some pretty obvious pieces of evidence that say that it's a lot easier to move a position player into a pitcher as opposed to a pitcher going into a position player role. And there's certainly some pretty good recent examples of that. So he moves up through the minor leagues, makes his major league debut at the end of the 1981, actually not the end, no, it's the middle of the 81 season. That was the split season. But he makes his debut in 1981 and doesn't really, you know, attract a whole lot of attention because he batted 182 for the season. Spent most of his season with the Orioles AAA Farm Club, which was in Rochester. And an interesting tidbit here, Ripken was one of the players involved in the longest pro baseball game in history, a 33-inning game between Rochester and Pawtucket. And of course, an interesting footnote to that footnote is the third baseman for the Pawtucket Red Sox was Wade Boggs. So you had two future Hall of Fame players playing third base for their respective teams in a game that took 3 days to complete. So he makes his debut. And the rest, as they say, is history. Finally, in the middle of the 2001 season, he announces that he is going to retire at the end of the season. And then you had the very, very, very ridiculously long farewell to Cal Ripken parade that was going on throughout the major leagues. He put on quite the show at the 2001 All-Star Game in Seattle. And then as his career wound down, it would finally come to a close at the end of the 2001 season. Of course, he's very, very well known not only for what he did on the field, but off the field. He is very much involved in minor league baseball and youth baseball. He owns several minor league baseball teams, has also been a key director, if you will, in youth baseball. He was really put off by how some parents would drive their kids really hard in youth baseball. So he's been advocating a more, what's the best word? I don't want to say humane, although there's some youth baseball that's not the right word to use. But a little gentler approach to coaching and encouraging kids playing baseball instead of going the old-fashioned drill sergeant kind of way. So he's still very much involved in baseball. And an interesting little note here, you may one day see a future Ripken playing in baseball. His son, Ryan, was drafted by the Washington Nationals a few years ago. Now, he is still in low A baseball at last check, but he's a first baseman, huge kid. I was looking at his stats. He's 6'6", 220. I mean, that's pretty big for a kid. Of course, his dad was pretty big. He was listed as 6'4", which for shortstop is very big. You know, the shortstop and the second baseman are typically shorter guys. But it'll be interesting to see if Ripken's son continues to stay with the Nationals organization and he makes it to the major leagues. Wouldn't that be something? Ryan Ripken playing for the Washington Nationals in the shadow of the Baltimore Orioles. And of course, he's always kind of been in the shadow of his father. But that would be a very cool thing if that indeed comes about. So, again, what more can you say about Cal Ripken? I think his career speaks for itself. His induction into the Hall of Fame, which was nearly unanimous, 8 votes shy of a unanimous selection. You have to wonder what the other 8 people were thinking. But he did get in along with Tony Gwynn. So a very magical Hall of Fame induction back in 2007 with those two incredible players, broke in around the same time, set a lot of the same records. And, obviously Gwynn didn't set the consecutive games record, but two of the best hitters, two of the best defenders, and the face of a franchise. Tony Gwynn is Mr. Padre. And I think for the 1980s and 90s, without doubt, Cal Ripken Jr. is Mr. Oriole. And I specify 80s and 90s because once you get before the 80s, you definitely have Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, Boog Powell, Jim Palmer you could jockey who's the face of the franchise then. But without a doubt, in the 80s and 90s, it was Cal Ripken Jr. So there you go, the incredible career of Cal Ripken Jr. on an incredible set. Again, 93 Upper Deck. A little harder to find some of the Series 2 just because they're a little more expensive because they've got those better inserts. But this is a set where, normally I say, you got $20, $30, buy a couple boxes. All right, if you've got $50, $60 hanging around, there's still plenty of 93 Upper Deck out there, but some really good cards. Maybe you hit one of those big inserts, or maybe you hit the one card that is still not only held its value, but increased over the years. That, of course, is the Derek Jeter rookie card from that set. Really the one standalone card, although some of the semi-star and star cards are valued a little more than semi-star and star cards from similar sets from that same year. So there you go, 93 Upper Deck. We're all done with that. We've got one more set in the Monster Box. And as opposed to some of these sets where I just had a handful of cards, I managed to keep a few more of these because it was one of my favorite sets in 1993. I remember buying a couple boxes of this set, both series as well. Even though it wasn't quite Upper Deck, even though it didn't have the flash and pizzazz and wow factor of a Leaf Studio or Top Stadium Club, 93 Tops was one of my favorite sets because it does look a little dated now when you look back at it, but it was another big advancement for the Tops set. A set that was pretty good in the late 80s and early 90s, took that giant leap forward quality-wise in 92, and I think they really did a bang-up job in 93. So we'll look at 93 Tops. We'll do a random pull on Tuesday's podcast. Then we will do our podcast on minor league cards, team-produced cards, and non-logo cards. So I'll go looking through my collection to see what I can find from those. So that means in about 2 weeks, we'll leave the Monster Box and we'll go into the big old binder as we go through the sets from 1954 through 1980. And much like we did from 81 to 93, we will go year by year, do a random pull, and we've got some great sets. There were some incredible baseball cards that were produced back then, and probably fewer superstars along the way, but that's all right, because sometimes you get the more interesting stories from the quote-unquote role players from those eras. So that's where we're going in the near future. It all starts with Tuesday's podcast on 93 Tops, the last of the big old Monster Box sets, and that will be coming your way via Audio Boom and iTunes. Don't forget, the conversation is always open for you to take part in at Wax and Gumstains on Twitter. Thanks again for those who participated in our survey. We will be taking your comments into effect over the next few weeks. And thank you for listening. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Again, appreciate you joining us on Wax Ecstatic.